This is the Business of College Sports podcast with your host, the founder of businessofcollegesports.com, Christy Dosh. Find her on Twitter and Instagram at Sports Biz Myths.
Welcome to the Business of College Sports podcast. I'm your host, Christy Dosh, the Sports Biz Myths. And today I get to bring on someone that I have been working with for more than a year now. His name is Thomas Thomas Jr., and he is the CEO and co-founder of BasePath, which is a fantastic software platform that allows student athletes and collectives and brands and even universities to collaborate on one platform when it comes to NIL deals. They help facilitate the transactions and the payments and ensuring that student athletes are doing the things they're supposed to do before they get their money released, and ensuring compliance paperwork ends up in the right hands, and that student athletes understand, you know, how much they've made, that they need to file on their taxes at the end of the year, all of that kind of fun stuff. They are trying to make life easier for the universities, for the student athletes, for collectives, and for brands who use their software. And they have amassed quite an impressive list of clients over the last year and a half or so. And they are a sponsor of my Business of College Sports website, and I am so grateful for their support. It is folks like them who allow me to do this as my full-time work and to bring you articles and podcasts and all of the resources that I bring for those of you who work in and around college sports. So a big thank you to BasePath for being a supporter of Business of College Sports. And I have become a big supporter and fan of theirs. Many of the collectives that I consult with work with BasePath. And so it has been a fantastic partnership that I hope continues for quite some time to come. But I thought it was time to bring BasePath on the podcast to tell everybody a little more about what they do, and whether you are working inside of an athletic department or with a collective or, you know, somewhere else in the NIL space where you're dealing with these transactions with student athletes on a regular basis, BasePath might be just what you need to do things more efficiently. So I will get out of the way and cut to our interview so Thomas can tell you more about BasePath.
Welcome to the Business of College Sports podcast, Thomas. I'm so glad you're here. Thanks for joining us.
Cannot tell you how excited I am to be doing this. Thank you, Christy.
We have been talking about having this podcast, I don't know, for a year now, I think, but the collective landscape has shifted so quickly that I think we kept pushing it back, and it's never going to stop evolving at this point, it doesn't seem like. So it's time to just dive in and take a look at where we're at with this right now. And the reason we're talking about collectives is because that's really what your business revolves around. And I was hoping you could tell people just a little bit about BasePath as a company and what it is you all do for collectives, but I know also for schools and for brands as well.
Yeah, sure. First of all, again, thank you for having us on. You are, for us, the go-to person that we look to for the truth and what's going on in real time. So you already know what we think of you and everything that you've done to help us out, but just have to start there with a big, big thanks. BasePath, we started off about 14 months ago. So just at the end of 2021, when we came into the space, we thought that we were going to be really primarily focused on bringing financial literacy and bringing some unique kind of aspects to student athletes in the NIL space. When we started, though, we actually got a call from a very big brand who was doing deals with a couple of hundred student athletes at the time. And it was a pretty simple, straightforward deal. It was social media posts for some cash. And even that kind of simple structure we found was incredibly difficult organizationally to operationalize. And we ended up kind of coming in and helping put together a solution for them to more efficiently operationalize it, from, contract execution, getting documents signed, to getting deals submitted to athletes, getting tasks to those athletes, making sure that the athletes are completing their work. A lot of these, certainly brands and, now collectives that are in the space, they want to make sure that they're doing things above board. They don't want to be responsible for the reason why, a kid or a team can't play on Saturday, or that mm-hmm. a school can't go to the playoffs or a tournament. So they're trying to ensure that they're doing things the right way. Kind of managing that without an operation system can be difficult to do. Trying to check on a, 200 different student athletes' social media accounts. Typically they have 3 to 4 different social media accounts to make sure that they did their post can be tiresome. And so we ended up turning.
I've seen some scary Excel spreadsheets where people are trying to keep track in Excel.
Without question. And so, at the time they were probably putting 20 or 30 hours of work into per week into trying to make sure that everything was being done correctly. They were writing physical checks to athletes. It was, tough. And we probably turned that into 20 or 30 minutes of work through the use of our software. And we kind of had an aha moment at the time and said, man, this is pretty great. Like, I wonder if there are other organizations out there that could use something like this. And it was right at that time, we launched that in January of 22, right when the Gator Collective popped up. And then, another collective, and now you've got 30 collectives, now you got 50 collectives, now you got 100 collectives. And we saw collectives as being very, from an operational perspective, similar to, a big brand that was trying to manage deals. You've got hundreds of athletes, typically thousands of deals, tens of thousands of transactions that you need to track and monitor and make sure that are all above board from both a compliance perspective, but also, a tax perspective. Like, maybe the NCAA may forgive you, the IRS won't. Those are the types of things that they needed some real help on. And so we've, designed a software to support those needs to, again, take a lot of the operational work kind of out of the humans and trying to automate it as best we can so that you don't have to have a bloated staff. And a lot of these folks are true startups. Like, they're trying to get something off the ground, bootstrapping it. And so our software helps them to really kind of move faster and more efficiently.
Yeah, what I think a lot of folks would be surprised to learn if they're not operating a collective, or even people who are newer in that space. You and I run calls called the NIL Collective Consortium, and we're going to get into that, put a pin in that for a minute, because we're going to dig into that some more. But, I've done consulting calls with close to 30, I think, different collectives now. And then we have a few dozen different collectives that have shown up for these calls. And I ran this survey and asked them some stuff about their operations in terms of startup money and budget, but also employees. And people are always shocked when I tell them that the vast majority of collectives do not have a full-time employee. It is really engaged, enthusiastic alums and boosters who are volunteering their time. And yes, some of the collectives have gotten big enough. They have hired full-time staff, but even the ones I know that have full-time employees, we're talking one or two, maybe three. Like, these are not complex, large organizations with a huge workforce, which is why companies like BasePath have become so necessary in this space, because you're really taking on a lot of that operational burden. Has that been your experience too with the collectives that you're working with, that they're largely volunteer led, or maybe some of the ones you're working with are a little different than the ones I am?
No, 100%. I mean, the spectrum with collectives is incredibly wide.
Yes.
You've got,
just to let people know, the budget difference when we did this survey ran from 20,000 to like 7 million.
Right.
So it is a huge spectrum these collectives are on.
Yeah. We have some collectives that are dealing in, 4 and 5 figure deals. We have other collectives that are dealing in 6 and 7 figure. Like, they're, it's a huge range of different types of organizations within this space. I will tell you, I think probably all of them have started from someone this is not their full-time job. I can't think of a single collective, certainly that we work with and even that I've met, or because we've also met with a bunch of them, through the consortium, but, as we've just kind of gotten our name more and more out there, I can't think of a single one where someone was starting this as their full-time job. Almost always it is someone who was asked, typically by, someone within the community to do something for, their school's athletes, and to try to keep up with the Joneses in some respect. I mean, I would be very curious to know if when the Gator Collective started that they knew what they were really going to set off in motion across the landscape of intercollegiate athletics. Because what it did is it basically set a new standard. And now I can't think of a Power Five school, you know, save maybe a handful that don't have a collective that's operational and running. And you're starting to see it go down now even further to lower D1, a couple of D2 schools that are popping out. We just talked to a D3 collective that's
starting. I've had several D2 and D3 calls lately. Yeah, I think that's where it's headed.
Yeah, but back to the original question. Yeah, the operations of these collectives, like particularly when they're starting, are typically folks that have full-time jobs already. So, I mean, we say that they're working part-time. Really, they're working nights and weekends. Like they're not even, mm-hmm. you know, divvying up half and half. It's, I have a full-time job as an accountant or lawyer, or, you know, I'm running my own business or whatever. And they are doing this as kind of a favor to the community that they're a part of. So, now I will say just a unique example, kind of in the opposite direction. I was just talking to a new collective, new to us, that they've been around for some time, that just recently brought on an entire staff. So they are now, and I think you're starting to see this with a lot of these groups, where they recognize you do need to have someone to help support the athletes, someone who can be there to answer questions, who can, you know, go out there and cultivate memberships and deals, and, you know, contributions. So you are starting to see that side, I think, grow up. But yeah, it's largely been, you know, a lot of folks that have been trying to bootstrap and, you know, do it themselves and try to do it as effectively and efficiently as they can.
When you all come in and start working with a collective, what are those sort of first things you're doing to onboard them and onboard their athletes and sort of start streamlining those things they've been running on their own?
Yeah, I think typically the first thing that we'll ask to see are, what contracts do you have in place and who are your athletes? The onboarding process for us is actually pretty fast and efficient. You know, I was just down with one of our collectives. We onboarded like a couple hundred athletes in less than 10 minutes. Like that's typically not that difficult. It's, you know, we use basic like QR codes and emails and stuff like that to get them up and running. And I'll also tell you, typically the easiest way to get an athlete to join your collective is to have a deal for them. So if you tell an athlete, hey, if you sign up, we're going to, you know, help you get a couple hundred bucks, or, you know, get you some free gear, whatever it may be. They're much more prone to sign up than otherwise. But I would say those are the two biggest ones for us, because, and this is just strictly talking from our software perspective, if we know what the contracts are, we know what the athlete's involvement is with those, we can design it so that the system will essentially automate the flow of task management. So if we know that a player has a 12-month agreement, in months 1 through 3, they have to do 3 social media posts a month. In months 4 through 6, they've got to do 2 live appearances. They've got to show up to tailgates. In months, you know, 7 through 9, they've got a podcast appearance and something else. In months, you know, 10 through 12, they've got other things. We can input that all into our system kind of pretty seamlessly, so that as the athlete goes through the calendar year, every single month, their tasks are getting changed and updated. They get notified when those things are coming due, so that they can get their work done in order to get paid. You know, our system is quid pro quo based. You know, we want to make sure that, again, we're protecting both the athletes as well as the groups that we're working with. So we do ask the athlete to make sure that they get their work done before we just send them, you know, the cash or the in-kind benefits. And our system can do that kind of automatically in real time. We send notifications and all that fun stuff to make sure that they're, you know, getting their work done and, have everything that they need to complete it appropriately. But I mean, those are the things when we're starting, we're typically trying to do. We also help on the contract execution side with, you know, different integrations to make sure that the athletes can, you know, have the appropriate type of support, whether that's an agent, whether that's, you know, a lot of schools have free legal services that they provide to athletes. You know, we certainly encourage every one of them to understand what they're signing as they're getting into it. And you know, we try to avoid I can't think of a single collective that we have that uses exclusive deals. You know, we try to keep them as broad as possible for the benefit of the athlete. But those are the types of things. And when we're coming on to a, you know, I say a campus, but really to a collectives community, we want to just make sure that we're doing everything right by the athlete and the organization as best we can.
And then you're also helping with, as far as compliance goes too, right? Like I know every school is different in terms of how they want that compliance documentation coming in and what other, you know, services the university itself might be using for compliance, but that's part of what you all do for collectives too, right?
Yeah. So we are, you know, at its core, like we are a data repository for everything that's going on within the collective at any given point in time, both in terms of what the deals are, the deal values, the timing, the athletes involved, but also we, you know, we house the task completion data. So, you know, we can at any given point in time share that data with a compliance office, however they see fit. So yeah, I probably should have mentioned this during the last question, but yeah, one of the first things that we do when we sign on with a collective is we ask to, first of all, do you have a relationship with the institution? If so, is there someone over there that we can speak to so that we make sure that we get all the data to them that they need? So, you know, we typically try to have a conversation with someone in the compliance office earlier on in the process so that we understand what their requirements are. And we can do, you know, data exports for them as they see fit. If they want their own dashboard, we can provide that too. You know, typically a school already has a solution, whether it's Open Doors or Influencer or you know, Athlines or ARMS, where they have different compliance reporting mechanisms. You know, we can slice and dice the data as they need it so that it can be entered into whatever system that they're using, unless you want to use us.
Yeah. Well, and so on the flip side of that, you all have now started signing university partners as well. What does that side of your business look like? What are you doing for athletic department partners?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was the tongue-in-cheek way of saying there are universities that are now using us for that. So, you know, the University of Minnesota, we recently signed on, which we're super excited about. But that really kind of came from the collective and then back to the university. And I don't want to speculate. I would imagine, though, from their side, when you're thinking about, you know, creating continuity for your athletes across NIL, if your collective is, you know, using a software that is working for their athletes, you know, it could make sense to have them use that for other things. You know, that said, we certainly are on campuses where there are multiple different apps. I think, thankfully, student athletes are of an age where, you know, they're capable of jumping in between different applications in a much faster time and pace than certainly I'm capable. But yeah, I mean, I think for the university partners, we're providing that. We provide some educational materials. We're moving more into the financial literacy side, so helping them understand, you know, when you think about student athletes, the financial picture here is actually pretty complicated. It's not just NIL. To be clear, I mean, there's a whole lot of different variables that go into, you know, what it means to be a student athlete, whether it's financial aid, Alston payments, Pell grants, maybe you have an internship, maybe you've got a job, maybe you're, you know, doing stuff kind of outside of, you know, even the realms of what you would consider kind of standard financing. And so helping them to understand the complexities that exist within that space, is something that we're trying to lean harder into. And I think we've provided some unique value to, you know, our university partners in that sense.
So you've been doing this for about 14 months now, and really we've been talking about what you're doing, and I've been sort of looped into what BasePath's doing for a year now. It feels like a very long year because a lot has happened in NIL and collectives in that time. But can you kind of think back over the last year, like, were there any big changes or shifts in terms of how collectives are operating or growing that have forced you all to sort of adapt your business for their needs as well?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. Because certainly there are.
I know it happens so fast that then when you look back, you're like, you realize how far you've come, but it all happened so fast that it's hard sometimes to pinpoint like where those pivot points were.
And I don't know that I've actually been able to like jump, like stay above water for long enough to really even understand what's happened. or to look back with like a real clarity of how we got here. I would say there are a couple of big ones though that shaped the way that we've tried to approach the group. One of the big ones was the NCAA's clarification on their guidance was huge. That kind of really gave collectives a ton more confidence. I think that
there were media members that were saying like collectives are going to go away. This isn't going to exist. I mean, I had people asking me like, what are you going to do when that's not part of your work anymore? And you're not consulting with collectives and you're not running your collective membership. Like, how are you going to shift? And I kept saying, I don't think they're going away.
Right.
And I think that NCAA guidance really made it clear that they're not going away because there's so many things that the athletic department itself cannot do for student athletes, but that collectives can do on their behalf. And I'm talking about like good beneficial things, not like under the table trying to skirt around the rules things, but like things that services collectives can provide that now athletic departments will have a harder time providing because the NCAA has essentially said, well, if you do it for athletes, you have to do it for everyone. And so I think we're starting to actually see a lot of things shift toward the collectives. And that's something a year ago, a lot of people would have said was going to be the exact opposite of what was going to happen because they were afraid collectives were just going to get wiped off the map. And thankfully for me and you, that hasn't happened.
No, someone was looking out for us up in Indianapolis, but it's funny. I got a call like the day that clarification came down. It was from a Power 5 AD and he just said, dude, I don't know who you thanked, but or like what you did, but I mean, it is a great day to be in the collectives business, and it has been, and I would say that's been a big one for us. I would say the other one that we have just kind of learned as we've gotten further and further into it is our software. When we started, was primarily everything that I explained is kind of money out, so it's helping get contracts facilitated, tasks completed and monitored, compliance disclosures made so that we can pay an athlete. At the end of the day, that's the terminal point is a payment is made. I could argue that the terminal point is actually submitting the 1099 and paying the taxes at the end of it too, which we do, by the way. But for the intention of this conversation, it's to get the money out to an athlete. A lot of these collectives that started up were typically started by a handful of men and women that wanted to collect their money together, like be a real collective in the sense of the word, to provide opportunities to student athletes. And I think what they realized pretty early on is this is not terribly sustainable. We don't want to be the underwriters of this collective forever. And so is there a way for us to kind of engage the community to be part of this journey with us? And what you started to see pop up were a lot of these collectives started to offer memberships and subscription options. And so we provided a solution, and thankfully it's probably become more popular than the operation software, helping these organizations manage the membership side. So, offering different products and tiers that, hey, we're going to give you the t-shirt and the hat and the decal for $15 a month. If you join the $100 a month, you're going to get this. We have some collectives for $10,000 a month. Marshawn Lynch will drive you in his, his golf cart to the game. If you didn't know, that's the Cal Collective. Unique experiences, the more you give, like, hey, you get dinner with a coach, or come and join with, sit with a couple of big time alumni and they'll take you up to their suite, really exciting opportunities and things that you probably just can't go to the local store and get, but that these collectives can help coordinate. So those are things that have taken off in a big way. And you're seeing now, this is public. I think I read it in an article that maybe even you probably published that, collectives now have thousands of members. I certainly know for the collectives that we have, there are thousands of members and millions of dollars that are, coming to these collectives through fans, folks, supporters, folks that want to be engaged. Some of the other things is like getting content from athletes, doing interviews, like our Minnesota Collective, they do a great job of, they get a lot of player content and in unique interviews that are only available to their members. That's Dinky Town Athletes for what it's worth. Those are the types of things that we have really kind of tried to help advance for these folks. And thankfully we've been able to test it and have made a bunch of improvements over, you know, these past 6-8 months. But I would say that's probably the other biggest shift that we saw and that changed kind of our arc as an organization.
Is there a big difference on your side of things, whether a collective is a for-profit and maybe they're, you know, membership-based versus being a 501c3, which even with the 501c3s, I know often they have people who are making monthly donations. And so they don't necessarily call it a membership, but, you know, you still have those kind of monthly touch points. On your side of things, is there a big difference in terms of how those collectives are run from a software perspective?
Yeah, I would say the biggest difference is for 501c3s, you need to provide different types of documentation. So, you know, typically if you're just an LLC that's offering a membership, you want to fulfill whatever your obligations are that someone signed up for. So we'll get them the shirt and the hat or whatever, or the coupon or the voucher to go shop at the store, which I think is actually the better model, like for what it's worth, instead of having to house inventory and ship it from your basement, just send them a code. Take them to your store. They end up buying more when they're there, for what it's worth. Like that side from an LLC perspective it's pretty simple. Like, hey, thanks so much for joining. We automate kind of like ongoing communications with them just to make sure that, hey, we're going to charge your card again this month. Hey, we're going to, you know, we're still super thankful. Hey, we've got these new unique events coming. Just donor management engagement 101, just making sure that the people are feeling like they're getting something for, you know, the investment that they're making in the organization that they're supporting. For 501c3s, there's more to it. You have to make specific calculations as it relates to, hey, I gave $10,000, but I'm going to receive for that $1,000 in benefits. Well, you can't write off $10,000 then because you've actually received something for it. So our system does process like the netting effect, and then it also will allow for, you know, the certain documentation that needs to be provided to those donors so that they can make the appropriate tax write-offs and have the things that they need in order to take care of their stuff at the end of the year. So I would say from a membership, like a member donor perspective, those are the two primary differences, is just in how you calculate the benefit and also how you communicate with them after the fact. But beyond that, I mean, that's pretty similar. Someone's going to link a bank account in ACH funds, or they're going to take out their credit card and, you know, or write a check or something.
Yeah. You know, as we've been hosting these collective consortium calls, and then as I've been doing consulting calls, I feel like in the last 6 months, probably since the end of last summer, there's been a real shift towards most of the collectives I consult with or even get press releases about, you know, to write about as a journalist are 501c3. Like, I still remember being pitched the first one, which was Horns with Heart. That got pitched to me by DM on Twitter, and that was like fall of 2021. And I remember writing the guy back and being like, run that by me one more time. Yeah. You want to do what? And I remember thinking, this is so scammy. Of course I'm going to write about it because people are going to lose their minds when I put this on Twitter. And that is what happened. People lost their minds. They thought it was scammy. I retract that now. I don't think it's scammy anymore. I get it now. It's been a very effective model for a lot of collectives. But, you know, in the beginning, I felt like most of the collectives that were being set up were for profit. They were membership based. There were like membership tiers for most of them where you got different things at different levels. But, you know, they tried to keep it affordable for like the everyday fan. Like, I know Gator Collective started at $9.99 a month, I think. And I haven't looked recently to see what they are now. But, you know, a lot of collectives had that model where there was a very low entry point where every fan could feel like they were part of it. And then we started to see this shift towards the 501c3 model. And some of the 501c3s in the beginning, at least, were very focused on just like a small pool of donors who were big money donors. Sure. And now I think that has shifted to where the 501c3s are really open to everybody. And they set up these sort of membership tiers, much like the for-profit membership based ones did. But most of the ones I see coming online either are 501c3s or they're coming online with both right. under one umbrella. They've got a for-profit arm and a nonprofit arm. Is that what you're seeing on your side the last 6 months or so also?
Yeah, I would say that is very much the trend that we're noticing. I would say we're probably noticing the trend more of the latter of folks coming with both at the same time, or they are, and this probably fits in the first category anyways, but they had an LLC and now they're attaching a 501c3 basically adjacent to it.
Yeah.
So I think you're seeing a lot more of those, like a lot of the 501c3s that you're talking about, they're coming as a partner to an existing LLC collective. Like that happened at, you know, Louisville's Collective 502 Circle, Pack of Wolves at NC State has a 501c3 component now. You know, there's dozens of others that you're starting to see that model. I do, yeah. As far as the scammy side of it, it's going to be super interesting to see what happens this year because we haven't gone through a real tax cycle yet to know what will be and what won't be acceptable to the IRS from a 501c3 perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard others that have set themselves up as a 501c7, a 501c6 to try to avoid what some attorneys have recommended to us could be the pitfalls of 501c3. And by the way, I don't have a dog in the fight. Like, you know, we support collectives regardless of their organizational structure. But I think that is going to be something that will be very interesting to watch. In the same way that we were waiting to hear what the NCA would say about collectives in 2022, I think we're going to be waiting to hear what the IRS has to say about 501c3 collectives in 2023. That stuff will be public, by the way. You know, a lot of 501c3 disclosures are public, so you can go and look them up. You can go into the IRS database and see what they have to say. It's going to be very interesting, and one that certainly a lot of the folks that we work with have a vested interest in understanding and knowing. And there's still a ton of speculation, and a lot of attorneys that we've spoken to have vastly different opinions on what's right and what's not. Ultimately, it will come down to the IRS to tell us what is and what isn't. But yeah, I think that's going to be a very important one to track as we head into this year.
Well, and I will give a shameless plug. I don't make you guys listen to ads during this podcast, so you're going to have to hear my shameless plug, which is for, you know, our collectives consortium calls, which I want to talk about in just a second. We've had a 501c3 accountant come in and talk from an accounting and an IRS perspective, what she thinks collectives need to be careful about. She came and talked to our collectives. They got to ask her questions. And then we actually, this month, our speaker is a 501c3 attorney who's going to come talk about the legal side of things. Those calls are only open to collectives because collectives ask questions that they maybe wouldn't want to ask publicly. We do verify everybody that gets an invite to those, and you have to be a founder or an employee of a collective to come to those. However, because I book those speakers and I get all that material together, I generally release some version of that does not have the specific questions or specific names of people that were in the call to my NIL Collectives Insider membership. We do have members there who are agents and attorneys and all sorts of other interested parties in the collective space. And so if we have somebody as an expert guest in the consortium calls, then usually some piece of their material ends up in my membership as well. So I'll link in the show notes my membership that's open to everybody. And then also I'll link the form to fill out if you are a founder or an employee of a collective and you want to be on our next call. I will put the link for that in the show notes so that you can sign up to get the emails for our next call. Shameless plug over, except that now I want to talk about the collective consortium calls because you brought this idea to me, like, what if we had a call that we invited collectives to where they could share best practices and talk to each other and ask questions? And sometimes you or I get to chime in as a expert on whatever it is, but often they're just helping each other. And it has been so cool because I think the first call we maybe had like 10 different collectives on. I think now we've had as many as 30 different collectives on at a time. Like it continues to grow because they don't necessarily know each other and everyone's new to this. And so it like warms my heart every time we get on one of these calls, because you'll have people from schools that are rivals on the football field or the basketball court, and they're on there giving each other advice about their collective. And so when I hear in the media or from fans about how bad collectives are and all the dirty stuff they think they're doing under the table and like how they're ruining things, where like I can't wrap my head around that most of the time. I mean, I know some of that is going on, but it's not the guys that get on our calls, right? Because the guys that get on our calls are like so generous about sharing information and strategies and tactics and call this lawyer, call this accountant, call this insurance guy. Like, it makes me so happy every time I get on one of those calls, because it's so neat and interesting to see the community sort of coming together. Because at the end of the day, all the people who come on those calls, they want to help student athletes navigate this, benefit from it. So much of the talk is around helping them with stuff after graduation and with their future careers. And unfortunately, you know, that's the piece that no one gets to hear but me and you, because we're on there hosting these calls. But I have so enjoyed being part of it. And I learned so much because I get to hear all these collectives talk about what they're doing. And I'm not there as a journalist. I always tell them it's off the record and that I'll never report on anything that I hear there. But it does, you know, help me to have that as sort of background information, you know, when I am reporting or when I'm consulting with a new collective. So thank you for the idea and for bringing me in on those calls. And hopefully there will be more collectives who hear this podcast and decide to join us, because, you know, now we bring in an expert every month and I learn from them. We had immigration attorneys last month and I learned so much. In fact, I was reading through the transcription of that this morning, because that is going to be released. Actually, that podcast episode will come out before this one does. So if you're listening to this podcast, go back a week and you'll find the immigration attorneys. They did agree to be recorded during the call so that I could use it for the podcast. But it's just become such a valuable resource. And I know the collectives who are part of it are so thankful. What has been your takeaway from being part of those calls?
Yeah, I think exactly what you just said. I mean, the community is fantastic. That is something that I, you know, regardless of what you think about collectives or NIL organizations, whatever you want to call them or what they want to call themselves, it is full of incredibly genuine people that do really care. Sure, there are some bad actors. They're not a part of those calls. Like, I've met a couple of them, but we don't work with them, and they certainly aren't a part of that, like, that community. I think the willingness and the generosity of, you know, these men and women that come together to share best practices, what's been working, what hasn't been working, what are the challenges, what are the opportunities. I mean, it's, you know, the cliche, all the rising tide, you know, raises all boats type of mentality. Yeah. But I think we are very fortunate in that we've got, I don't even know that we had 8 or 9 on the first call. I think we may have had like 4 or 5, but and now
not everybody trusted us on the first call. I don't think there was this like ice breaking, like, who are these people? Yeah. What are we all doing here? But now people email me and they're like, I just found out about the calls. Why haven't I been on them? I'm like, well, I didn't know you existed, you haven't reached out to me before, but we'd love to have you on the next call. Like, now people find out about it and they want to come on, and people are so open to sharing, which
And I would say
magical to see.
Even the best part that I've seen from it is the relationships that get taken offline. And we have heard from so many different folks that come to the consortium. They hear something that someone else has said, and we ask everyone kind of going into it, like, hey, do you mind if we share your contact information with this group, only this group? And that goes back to the why it's, you know, collectives only. We don't want to have a whole huge audience there. One is for the safe space that you mentioned, but two, it's like, hey, if you don't want to share it, no sweat at all. Like, no big deal. But if you don't mind, sometimes you'll hear someone say something, and obviously we try to keep them less than 60 minutes, and they typically run to 90 to 2 hours, and we're having to cut it off. But typically you will hear someone say something. You could have a 2-hour conversation just on that point alone. And so we've heard a ton from folks that have connected offline, that have created like real relationships. Like, I was just talking to, I'm going to be down in Florida, you know, visiting a couple of, you know, folks. And we were talking to one of the collectives down there. They've got collectives from the north that are coming down to visit them because they've just developed those relationships and they're coming down to see the operations and they're going to go up to see what they've got going. It's really cool to see the community that's kind of come out of it. Yeah, I mean, selfishly for us, I think it's a great way for our company to understand what the needs are within the industry. We get to hear all the time the worst parts of being a collective. And thankfully, you know, we can hopefully provide solutions that, you know, make it easier to optimize what they're doing. That to me has been the greatest gift is obviously getting to meet the people and being involved in that community, but understanding what the pain points are so that we can create solutions to make it easier on them as they're kind of going out there and trying to succeed and, you know, grow this new industry.
And I know a lot of the folks that listen to this podcast work inside of athletic departments. And so for those of you who are still leery of collectives, I understand. And I do think there are some out there who aren't doing things the way I would advise. We'll just leave it at that. But I have to tell you, the number one thing that comes up on these calls is collectives asking for advice about how to develop a better relationship with their athletic department. Oh, yeah. Every single one of them wants to have a good, strong, you know, trusting relationship with the athletic department. Some of them had that right away because the folks who are involved in the collective came from the athletic department. You know, we've seen people leave athletic departments and go into work in collectives, right? Or you have seen people who leave the foundation and go over to the collective. And so that relationship exists from the very beginning, but other collectives have to work very hard at it and very hard at educating the athletic department about what they're trying to do and ensuring them that they're following the rules and that, you know, they have the student athletes' best interests at heart. And I say all that just because for those of you who do work inside athletic departments who are sitting here listening to this episode, I just want you to know how badly they all want to do things the right way and want to develop a relationship with you. Like, that comes up on every single call that we have. And so I just encourage you to have an open mind and be willing to take those meetings and listen to them and answer questions and hear what they're all about and what they're trying to do, because I think the vast majority of them are trying to do things the right way and can be a huge benefit to your department.
Yeah. And just to follow up on that, I think you are starting to see a shift more towards athletic departments being willing to, you know, out loud say we support this organization. I mean, January 12th when we're recording this. Like, the Syracuse AD just announced, you know, we're in support of two other collectives. Like, Ward Manuel in Michigan just said four collectives that he's, you know, that they support, you know. It seems like every day you've got another athletic director that's coming out there and saying, hey, we are behind, you know, the organizations. So for our money, what we have seen is there's a direct correlation between, are you connected with your university? Do you have at least a working relationship or, you know, that trust that you mentioned, and how successful that collective is doing within the community? If you don't have it, support may be too strong a word, but if you don't at least have an understanding of what the university is thinking about you and how they are positioning themselves with you, and whether that juxtaposition is we have to keep a certain length, because from state to state it can be different in terms of how far a department can go. But those are the types of things that, for me, like, it's one of the first questions we ask when we meet a collective is, what is the relationship like with the institution? Because it just becomes vitally important as you get further and further into this, because you're dealing with their athletes with, you know, a lot of times you're going to be at their events. And so we are starting to see more and more of that kind of working relationship. So far as now, you've got a lot of collectives that are licensing the brands and the marks, and whether or not that's facilitated through Learfield or through, you know, the royalty department directly or the business office. You know, those are the types of things that are happening, which is super encouraging to see.
Last shameless plug is that I said our next expert in the group is a 501c3 attorney. Our next one we have lined up after that, group licensing. So yeah, if you're a collective listening to this and you want in on those calls, those are hot topics with our group that we've got coming up. I'll put the link to sign up for those in the show notes. I'll put the link for my collective membership as well. And then Thomas, where can they find more about BasePath? And I'll make sure we get those links in as well.
Sure. Well, feel free to email me directly. It's Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S, at basepath.co.co. Or you can visit our site there at basepath.co. Or you can click on the lovely banner on Christie's Collective tracker. Yes. That sends them to where they need to go. But yeah, no, really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. As you know, we're super passionate about it and have really enjoyed getting to be involved in the space. And I mean, if there is anything that has been more exciting than getting to know you, Christy, I don't know what it is. That's been by far the best part of all of it.
Well, I love getting to talk to so many collectives and work with them. And I'm so glad that we've gotten to do a lot of this together. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I will make sure we get all your information down in the show notes for everyone. Appreciate you being part of the episode.
Thank you so much, Christy. Appreciate it.